So thank you very much for that warm welcome, Joy, and welcome to everyone. It's really an honour to be here and to have been asked to do this lecture. It's also a privilege to be able to share something around this theme of mindfulness, which 5 years ago, perhaps, certainly 10 years ago, probably in a room like this, most people would not have known what that term meant. And something's changed in our society because it's become really quite a buzzword. And that's quite fortunate for someone like me, who's a teacher of mindfulness. And in the course of the lecture today, I'm going to be exploring that, exploring what mindfulness is, why it seems to have struck a chord, what the significance of that is. And also I want to give an expanded, an expansive understanding of what I understand by the term mindfulness, which is not exactly the same as what I do as a mindfulness teacher. So I am a mindfulness teacher and I teach, you know, a certain set curricula of mindfulness-based this, that and the other. But I'm also a Buddhist, so I want to explore the extra dimension, the spiritual dimension of mindfulness as I understand it. But I want to start with actually doing some, doing a period of mindful reflection. So if you're willing, I'd like to invite you to join in. Now, I'm going to do the rigmarole that I usually do when I teach mindfulness. I invite you to find a way to sit that feels alert, your feet planted firmly on the floor, that also feels comfortable and relaxed, and I invite you to close your eyes. If that feels okay, if you don't want to, that's fine, but you know, not looking around the room. So this is the kind of practice that I would lead many times in organisations and other settings. And when we do something like this, the first thing is we stop. And when we stop, we notice that we don't really stop because our thoughts are still connected with all the things that we've been doing, all the things that have been stimulating us. You probably just notice there's a kind of buzzy energy and thoughts going through our mind. So when we do something like this, we're making a transition. We're going on a sort of a journey. And where we're going to arrive is in the present moment. So if we just notice the most immediate present moment sensations, noticing the feet touching the floor. So not thinking about the feet so much as sensing the contact, the resistance, the pressure. Noticing, sensing bottom in contact with the chair, the weight pressing down, and sensing the whole body, feeling the torso, the limbs, the head, feeling the whole height of the body. And letting the eyes be soft. And perhaps taking a slightly deeper breath, a more intentional breath. Letting the breath flow in. Letting the breath flow out. Noticing the sense of letting go as we breathe out. So we can take another deeper breath. And breathing out and settling. So we'll just keep our attention with the breath. noticing the tummy rising, settling. And if we notice, as is very likely, that all sorts of thoughts are still buzzing around, we just bring our attention to the breath again and again. Noticing the sense of stillness. And now, shifting our awareness from our tummy to the heart, also moving as we breathe. The muscles are affected, the lungs move as we breathe. And now, imagining that in our hearts, somewhere in the core of the body, we catch a glimpse of a jewel. Noticing its colour, its radiance. The light emanating from the jewel that pervades the body in some way. And just staying with this image and the feeling of the breath. Sense of settling. And then moving towards the end of this period of practice, just externalizing our senses, becoming aware of the room around us, sounds, light, moving our fingers, moving our toes, gradually bring the meditation to a close, and when we're ready, opening our eyes and rolling the shoulders. So I'm used, when I teach meditation, to at this point doing what we call inquiry. How was that? I'm not going to do that today. Sorry. I'm not the voice on the Headspace app. I'm sorry, but with 200 million downloads, I rather wish I was the voice on the Headspace app. Ah, okay. So what we did was a mindfulness practice plus a little bit. And we might just reflect, was what we did a relaxation practice? Was it something to do with well-being? In other words, was it something we could frame in wholly secular psychological terms? I teach this sort of thing in prisons, in hospitals sometimes, in schools, for members of the general public, in the form of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This is something you can get on the NHS. In that context, it has to be secular. Or is it something spiritual? And what do we mean by that? Or is it perhaps something religious? Now, I added an extra bit to the usual mindfulness practice, which was the jewel I asked you to imagine. We don't do that as part of the standard MBCT or, you know, the standard mindfulness things. But I thought it's partly because I'm going to come on to jewels at the end of my talk. I thought I would just bring that in. And again, just by way of reflecting, what difference did that make? Now, when we're feeling our feet on the floor, how would that be religious? And yet, if by attending to our bodies, our feet, and our immediate physical sensation, our mental experience changes, is that not the stuff of spirituality? And if spirituality, if religion means anything, then surely religion includes spirituality. So perhaps feeling our feet on the floor could be an aspect of something spiritual or religious. Now, that's perhaps something we can debate, I suppose. But once we start to bring in the realm of imagery, we connect with those spiritual traditions in a different sort of way. So I don't know what jewel you imagined. Perhaps it was a pearl. Perhaps if you're a Christian, given that this is this lecture is partly under the auspices of the cathedral, perhaps the image of a pearl brought to your mind the image of purity that we have in the Book of Revelations and in that wonderful medieval poem, The Pearl. Perhaps it was a ruby. And perhaps the thought came to your mind that it's connected with wisdom, which is more precious than rubies. Perhaps if you're a Buddhist or have a Buddhist inclination, it was a diamond. And it brought to mind the famous Buddhist text, the Diamond Sutra, the first book ever printed, and a work of extraordinary mystery and power, in which the diamond is a symbol for reality, the truth that goes beyond concepts and constructs. So once we start to introduce imagery, we can see that the resonance of those images takes us into these other worlds. So we don't actually do that when we teach mindfulness, and the Headspace app doesn't include that sort of imagery, even though it's imagery without any particular doctrinal content. And I think that's really helpful. I can go into all sorts of settings to teach mindfulness, and it started really that the kind of mindfulness that I do that's become so popular started with someone called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a meditator, perhaps a Buddhist, although his children have bar mitzvahs, so that's not very Buddhist, and he doesn't call himself one. And he founded, in the early in the 80s and 90s, he founded something called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And that's an eight-week program, which really is very brilliantly constructed. It distills everything that he had learned from his years of meditation practice, which, you know, come from the Buddhist tradition, but combine it with a sort of psychological awareness, and it was rigorously tested and so on. And so there's been a whole research strand that's gone along with the development of mindfulness in these mainstream settings, especially after it was taken up by a group of leading cognitive therapists in the UK who started something called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is prescribed, it's NICE recommended for avoiding depression relapse through the NHS. So in these ways, there's been this transition from the spiritual tradition into a setting where it can't be religious. You can't prescribe Buddhism on the NHS, for better or for worse. But what really is it that's involved in this? So mindfulness-based stress reduction frames the practice as a way of reducing stress. In other words, something to do with, I don't know, relaxing maybe, something to do with well-being. These terms are very general, but they're very pervasive. But actually, in important ways, mindfulness-based stress reduction isn't really simply about relieving stress. And it's certainly not about relaxation. And this is because, I think, of the Buddhist basis of it all. And in Buddhism, Buddhism asks the question, what is the underlying cause of our stress? What is it? You know, people often come on my courses and they say, I've got a very, very stressful job. My life is so stressful. You know, I've had this experience. And, of course, I sympathise with that and I understand exactly what they mean. But I'm also aware that the person sitting next to them in that office or someone having similar life experiences might not experience them as stressful. In other words, stress is not about the external conditions. That there are challenges, there are difficulties, there are demands that life places upon us. But stress is how it feels on the inside. Stress is an experience. So what is the underlying cause of that stress? It's not the fact that I work 12 hours a day or 18 hours a day, although thankfully I actually don't. But it's stress in Buddhist terms is what we call dukkha. Stress is a dukkha is, if you know anything about Buddhist teachings, you might recognize it as the term that's the first of the noble truths, the four noble truths of Buddhism. The Buddha said, well, all of life is dukkha. And it means something like unsatisfactory. It means that life, all of our lives, to a greater or lesser extent, but everyone, inevitably, there's an element of pain and an element of suffering. And in a sense, nothing that we experience is wholly, fully, really satisfying. There's a sense of incompleteness that is part and parcel of being a human being. Most of the time, we spend our lives complaining about what life has given us, feeling that if only I could get past this bit. What's going on in your life right now? Some kind of struggle, no doubt. If only I could get past this bit. If only I could earn enough money. If only I could get through my studies. Once I've done that, once I sorted out my relationship, once my child has got through his struggles at school, then it'll all be all right and I'll be able to get on with it. That's when I'll really live. Or maybe when I go on holiday. Although, unfortunately, you take your mind with you on holiday. Or maybe if you're a Buddhist like me, you think, I'll go on retreat and I'll be lovely and quiet and then I'll be able to really go much deeper into my own experience. But, unfortunately, I also take my mind on retreat and I find myself on retreat thinking about all this other stuff. So there is no perfect situation. There is no point where it's all going to stop and it'll be all right. But somehow our brains seem to be constructed. Do you recognise what I'm talking about? Yes. I try to remind myself of this every day. I do a little meditation that's called the Four Reminders. The first one of these is, I am going to die and I don't know when. A friend of mine told me a couple of days ago that he was listening to an audio book as he was driving down the motorway. It was a Buddhist audiobook, and it came to a point where the audiobook said, and this reflection is that we don't know when we're going to die, it could be at any time. And at that point, driving down the M4, a lorry careered into his car, flipped his car around, and pushed it hundreds of yards down the motorway while the audiobook was still playing. Anyway, that's what my friend told me yesterday, and it just really struck in my mind that it's true that this isn't just a pious platitude. We will all die, and we don't know when or how. It really is true. I also remind myself, second of these reminders is that the world cannot satisfy me, which is not just the title of a James Bond film, almost. It's that all of these kind of plans and obsessions and fantasies which I entertain myself, none of them are really going to get down to the root of what will bring happiness to me. I mean, my mind doesn't seem to want to learn that lesson, which is why these things need to be practices. So, dukkha. The Noble Truths say that the cause of dukkha is craving. It's that wanting things to be different. And that the cessation of craving is the cessation of dukkha. And then there's a path. Those are the Four Noble Truths. But really what this is saying is we need to look into our minds. If we want to understand ourselves or our lives, we need to start to look at our minds. Stand back and reflect on them. And we start just by noticing, you know, noticing that my mind's all over the place. But when we do that, other things emerge. So, I, as I said, I've found myself taken out of my little Buddhist enclave into all sorts of settings. One of the most powerful of these is, particularly over the last couple of years, I've found myself working with in prisons and with men on probation. I've done a lot of courses and a big trial of men on probation. And the guys recently released from prison. They come to the course, sometimes they've been told to, with a lot of resistance, a lot of doubt, and their minds are all over the place. But sometimes that's where it stays for however long they stay on the course, and sometimes something really dramatic happens. I mean, I have no idea how or when these moments will occur, but sometimes I lead people through a meditation like we just did without the jewels, and, you know, one time someone said to me, that is the first time in my life that my mind hasn't been racing on at 100 miles an hour. Another time someone said to me, he'd been in prison for a very long time, that is the first time in, I think he said 30 years, that I've experienced a sense of peace, which is quite shocking. That it's shocking that someone experiences no peace for a 30-year period. And it's a bit shocking that it's something that's really quite simple can open that door for someone. And that no one's ever shown them how to do that before. It's not me, it's not even the practice. If this practice was some kind of magical thing, then, you know, that would be very nice. But it's not about it being exotic. It's the fact that our minds have the capacity to calm, to soothe, and to experience peace. That's how mindfulness works. It's about accessing that capacity, learning the skill of being able to access it. Learning, in other words, that there's more to our experience than responding to what life throws at us right now. And my reflection on that work in prisons and with people coming out of prison is that really there are two prisons. There's the one with walls and bars, but the men I meet have been released from that. But they're still in another prison. It's an internal prison which is built from our habits, our mindset, our way of thinking, our emotions, our experience of the world as a place that's threatening. What William Blake called the mind-forged manacles still hold those people when they've been released from the literal prison. And I find that very moving. I find it moving to see those manacles so manifestly. But also I reflect that, you know, a prison is a literal institution, but it's also a metaphor. And that many of the other people I see who are maybe very depressed. And in this group, I don't know what your experience is. I don't know what your friends and family's experience is. But in most groups I encounter, there are people who are right now experiencing something like that, a mental prison, or at least know someone who's in that world. And it's a kind of a trap. So that, again, depression, anxiety, all those sorts of forms of mental illness, which are very much on the rise in our society, are ways in which we become trapped in sort of mental prisons. But all of us, and this is what William Blake is saying, in every voice of every man, the mind-forged manacles I hear. He's a universal condition. But at the same time, the mind has other capacities. And that's what we are exploring with mindfulness. Now, what those capacities are is construed in a certain way if we're in a psychological, if we're thinking of them psychologically. It's the mind's, it's our capacity to ground ourselves, to calm down, to settle down, to stand back from that cascade of thoughts, to do what psychologists call metacognize. Metacognition is standing back and noticing your thoughts. But if we see that prison, it's not just about a certain psychological process, but something more fundamental, something closer to the core of our being, then the what we're accessing is a kind of inner wisdom. It's a soul-like quality that is what gives us the perspective on our normal state of mind. So I want to just turn to a couple of spiritual, religious sources for this idea. In a beautiful Buddhist scripture called the Lotus Sutra, we have the story of what's called the story of the return journey. In some ways, it's a bit like the parable of the lost son in the Bible. A man goes to a friend's house, gets drunk, and falls asleep. His friend stitches a priceless jewel into his garment as a present and departs, though the man knows nothing of it. Waking up, he travels to another country, where he undergoes great hardship and is content, even if he can obtain just a little. Later, his friend happens to meet him and says, "How have you come to this? I tied a priceless jewel within your garment, and it's still there. Go now and exchange that jewel for what you need and do whatever you want, free from poverty and shortage." And so that's a Buddhist image that says that though we have no idea most of the time, there is a priceless jewel stitched into our garment. If we can find it, we will have all the riches of the world. You can see it's a bit like the parable of the lost son. There's actually a closer Christian analogy, which is a beautiful Gnostic story called the Hymn of the Pearl, in which a father sends his son to Egypt, a foreign country called Egypt, to salvage a pearl which is at the bottom of the lake and guarded by a serpent. And while he's in Egypt, the son gets distracted and forgets his journey. And then a voice comes to him to remind him that he's become a slave in Egypt, like the Israelites, to remind him to remember the pearl. Remember why he's come to Egypt in the first case. So this is from one of the Gnostic Gospels. If you haven't come across this in your usual liturgy, then it's because it's in something called the Gospel of Judas, which probably doesn't get read very often in Winchester Cathedral. It's this idea that we are in a foreign country. We've got drunk, like in the Lotus Sutra, or we've lost our bearings, as in the Hymn of the Pearl. We need to remember why we're here. We need to discover that pearl. Within Buddhism, within the Lotus Sutra, the pearl is what's called bodhicitta, the heart or mind that's set on awakening for oneself and for all other beings. Not seeing this religious, spiritual life as something that's about me alone, because that's a misunderstanding of what it is to be human. What it is to be human is to be with others. So the Mahayana Buddhist ideal is one of complete spiritual altruism. And the idea is that if we can remember that, remember that there's this impulse towards service, towards compassion. Compassion which is leading to the end of suffering by helping humanity, helping other beings to wake up to the true nature of our lives and to the resources that we have, albeit forgotten within us. That is the bodhicitta, the heart or mind of awakening. So those of us who teach, those of us, whether we teach mindfulness, we teach spirituality, whether we share our faith, our Christian faith or our Buddhist faith, our role is to be in touch with that jewel. And if we're not teachers, if we're friends, if we're people who want to lead good lives, meaningful lives, our role, our task is to remember that jewel. Remember what is most precious. Perhaps we express that through the language of a religion, of religious teachings, doctrinally. But we live in a society which doesn't use that language, where people are, we are looking for meaning, and we're not looking for it in the terms, usually, of our religious traditions. So, of course, we can convert people, and then they'll learn that language. But for most people, we need to speak to them. We need to find ways. We need to find practices and teachings that address what we really care about. And what we care about most is our suffering. The power of mindfulness as a movement in society is that it starts with what people really care about. I am suffering. I am depressed. I am anxious. I am stressed. I don't like it. I want to live more fully. I want to be alive. I don't want my life to go by in this fog of stress. The endless demands of my job and my family. I don't want that. I want to be alive. Mindfulness speaks to that. And it's a powerful connection. It comes from something that's really important to us. And I see my role when I teach mindfulness as recognizing that in people and remembering that jewel. The profound meaning beneath the surface of stress and distress. So thank you.